This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The first Black faculty member at the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance was Willis Patterson, a well-known opera singer of his day. He worked to elevate the voices of African-American composers, musicologists, and performers as part of his long academic career.
There's an old man called the Mississippi. That's the old man that I'd like to be. What does he care if the world's got troubles? What does he care if the land ain't free?
He's being remembered this weekend at this year's African American Music Conference in Ann Arbor. And, well, I guess it's actually happening everywhere if you're attending online. Dr. Louise Toppin is a professor of voice at the University of Michigan and one of the organizers, and she joins us now. Professor Toppin, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Willis Patterson was born at the height of the Great Depression. Do you know much about his childhood and his, sort of his musical upbringing?
I do a little bit. He grew up in Ann Arbor, and he shared with me that he and his mother and grandmother raised him, and he would hear songs such as Wings Over Jordan on the radio on Sunday mornings. And so he went into the Army and had a circuitous route and then ended up at the University of Michigan as a student. He didn't think he would be able to get in. I believe he went to Eastern first and then was able to get into the University of Michigan to start a degree. And it is hearing those voices around him in the church and on the radio that encouraged him as a singer.
I read that he had some reluctance about coming back to Ann Arbor. Did he ever talk to you about that?
Absolutely. We actually are connected in that he taught at Virginia State University, which is where my parents taught. So they were family friends when I was a child. So I met Willis Patterson as a four-year-old. And it's, again, a circuitous route. He loved the environment there. It was an intellectual community of African-American scholars. It had composers like Undine Smith Moore on the faculty. So I grew up around these people who were stellar artists and who did a lot with African-American music and history. My father was in Civil War and Reconstruction. That was a nationally known figure in that area. So that was the community. So he didn't want to leave it to come back to Ann Arbor, and they had to entice him back to Ann Arbor. But he, you know, was certainly glad once he came, and also to leave the safety of a community of Black scholars, which he'd said he'd never, he'd had on his previous jobs in the South at historically Black schools, mm-hmm. but he had not had growing up in Ann Arbor or being a student at Michigan.
Right.
So for him, that was a hard choice to leave what, such a thriving community of Black scholars to come to Ann Arbor. But people like me who did a doctorate here are glad that he did.
Right. Now, Willis Patterson is perhaps most famous in musical circles for having been the first person involved in a television production of Amahl yeah. and the Night Visitors. The part that he played, the King Balthazar, was traditionally played by a white singer in blackface. How was he able to get into that role? What was the process that brought him to that point?
Well, I am still amazed by that story and the gumption that it took. He would have been about 40 years old, and I think about where I was as a 40-year-old singer. You're still trying to ascend the ladder of, you know, in your career, and to have the gumption to write to the head of NBC and say, you know, you've been putting these productions of Amahl on television and you're not using African-American singers when there are a plethora of trained African-American singers. You should consider using an African-American singer.
This was in 1963, we should say.
In 1963. And so having that gumption and all that's going on in the world in terms of civil rights in the 60s, here he is, a relatively unknown young singer writing this to such an entity. And they answered him and said, okay, we're going to hold auditions. you're invited to come audition. He went and auditioned and won the part.
Now he was a bass. Would you perhaps tell us about his singing voice?
Oh, it's so superb. I mean, the bass voice is one of those that is a more rare commodity. There are a lot of baritones, but having the depth of those sounds, if you can imagine someone who sings Old Man River and sings those low notes so richly and deeply.
There's an old man called the Mississippi. That's the old man that I'd like to be.
He had a wonderful musical sense. He lived he studied a Fulbright in Germany, so he loved the taste of languages, German and French and Italian. He had a wonderful sense of style, but also his interpretation of spiritual and African-American music was so compelling. But it was a lush, gorgeous quality. And then he also did some things in jazz.
See, I've got a lot to learn. I'm trying not to learn, since this is the perfect spot to learn. Teach me tonight.
Did Willis Paterson ever talk to you about his path into the industry and just what it took for him to get to the place he wanted to be in his career?
He did. That his start in the industry was... He started with his teaching and then also with the Fulbright that he was in Europe and starting to sing and do concerts throughout different parts of Europe. And he told me a story the other day about, I think he was in Italy and he did a concert that had, you know, all Italian repertoire, or I'm sorry, it was Germany. He did an all German concert and they asked him why he wasn't singing music of his own homeland. And so that started his quest of work to find Africa. He contacted all the people he knew from the HBCUs to get some repertoire sent to Germany so he could begin to incorporate American music. And so that began his path in terms of his scholarship, which was appealing to universities as well as his wonderful teaching, but a research interest in African American music at a time that no one was really... There was a small cohort of composers and scholars, but not performers performing this repertoire. So he carved a niche for himself just by that simple act of beginning to talk about, teach, and sing African-American repertoire.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Professor Louise Toppin. She teaches voice at the University of Michigan. You worked with Willis Paterson when he was still very active on faculty and had a chance to see him in action. What was he like as a teacher?
Dean Paterson, I was his assistant. My job was to work with minority students. I was a minority peer advisor and an assistant in terms of his music. But I did get a chance. I was in many of his lessons because I was a pianist before I became a singer. And so I had a chance. He was very enthusiastic in his lessons. He was meticulous with detail. He expected the best for his students, and yet it was such a warm and it was an exacting moment, but he was also a warm and supportive teacher. That's the word I'm looking for. I came to the university as the second woman after Shirley Verrett. I'm not the second faculty member because George Shirley and other people have joined. Several men have been on the faculty, but I'm only the second woman. And so it's an honor to come from that legacy of George Shirley and Willis Paterson. I still call him Dean Paterson, as you can see.
Right.
And I was also, he's a person that he went and got a doctorate well into his career. He was already at Michigan before he pursued a doctorate. And not that he needed it. He already had an appointment as the associate dean. But he was a person who said, you know, if I'm going to teach doctoral students and talk about this scholarship, he felt he needed the doctorate in education. And so he went in and got one. And in an older age, which was pretty, I'm in awe in all the many things that he did for minority students, for the profession, and as a wonderful performer.
What were some of the ways that he helped students who maybe had trouble seeing their way through, you know, how they would find their way into the singing roles that they wanted, or just how they would build a career over time?
Well, he was fantastic in terms of, first, if he knew any student was struggling, a student of color, I remember seeing him standing out in the hall and saying, so-and-so, come into my office. And we all knew what that meant. When he was standing there to say, come into my office, he was going to have a serious talk. And he didn't mince words in terms of making sure that people were on the straight and narrow. But he was also good. He instituted the minority peer program, of which, as I said, as a doctoral student, I was one. And my job was to keep an eye on other students and offer help and find, you know, theory tutors if they needed, or pair them up with other students who were working successfully. So he created a community for us as students at Michigan, where you knew you were supported by not only him, but the other African-American or faculty of color. And then in their careers, he would take that next step. He was always, and for all of us, me even though I wasn't his student, he would call people and say, you need to hear this singer. You need to invite this person to be a part of this. And even I remember one of my first gigs he did do. He invited me to be the gala artist at the National Association of Negro Musicians when I was just finishing my doctorate at Michigan. And I have since joined the organization, and I've been on the board for many years and other things. And I've come to know the gala artists were people like Leon Bates, who were famous stars. They weren't some kid who had just finished a doctorate, but he felt so strongly about what I was doing at Michigan that he insisted that I be that year's gala artist and connected me to people like Sylvia Olden Lee, who was the first African-American at the Metropolitan Opera. And William Warfield. I mean, they were all members of this organization. So he nurtured and mentored students, whether they studied with them or not, and opened doors and continues to open doors for people along this path.
What does it mean to be able to do this for Willis Patterson while he's still alive? He's still with us.
Yes. Oh, that was the reason I did it. I did a conference last year, and in 1985, did a big conference that brought together scholars, performers, and composers, and brought thousands of people together. And so in my appointments, the last one before here was, I was a director at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, of their music program. And I did two conferences that did the same thing, brought the communities together. And so I did one last year at Michigan, in my second year at Michigan. This is my third. And I decided for this year that as he turned to 90, we needed to honor him. And as you said, we needed to do it while he can enjoy it and be a part of the celebration, because his legacy touches us not only as a performer, as a teacher, as an administrator. My journey into leading a major music program is in part because of him and the counsel that he gave me when he was the associate dean, but also his work as an advocate. He's been an active member of the Ann Arbor community and the larger Michigan community. And so I wanted him to know and hear from all those sectors how much he is appreciated for the work that he did and continues to do. And then more importantly, I wanted him to see his legacy. I've invited many alums back who are pioneers in their own right and have extended from what he's done into the community and into their communities all over the United States. So this conference celebrates him in so many ways, but also celebrates the music that he loved. And I'm honored and thrilled to have thought of doing it and to be able to carry off and host a conference that will celebrate Willis Patterson.
I just wanted to ask, while we've got you, this is such an unusual time for musicians and music students, and you're continuing to give lessons, even as students are being asked not to show up in rehearsals and concert halls. How are voice lessons going right now?
They're going well. I mean, we're figuring it out. I was fortunate that for many years before the pandemic, I actually taught students in Africa. I had a whole cohort that I would teach using FaceTime. So I had some experience teaching with technology prior to the pandemic. And so when the pandemic started, I was still using FaceTime. And then as Zoom evolved and we got microphones and things like that, it's actually going well. There are some things that, of course, you can't do as well as you can do in person, but the students are taking a different ownership, which is actually really good because of being in this format. I think it gives them some freedom. And then we're also able to use the technology to record their lessons, to have studio class, which I have this afternoon. All 15 of them will be on the call and they'll perform for each other live.
Oh, wow.
So we're figuring it out, and I'm a cheerful type of person, a half full type of woman. And so I try to keep a positive attitude, and, you know, I certainly long for being back in person. But my students have embraced what we're doing with technology and we go from there.
What are you telling them about what their careers might be like post-pandemic?
Well, I'm trying to prepare them for some realities. If opera companies are struggling at this point and are closed, that, you know, for the next year, they may not do in-person auditions as companies are struggling or they're unable to open. So I'm teaching them how to do Zoom videos so that they can successfully enter competitions, enter auditions, but also I've always talked to my students about having a skill set that's broad so that you're not afraid to create a career that fits who you are. And it may not look like the traditional career. I'm a person who did not have a traditional career in the sense that I went to college as a pre-med major. I have 2 degrees in piano. I have the last 2 degrees in voice. So I started singing at 25.
Wow.
I own a business. I've been an executive for a music program. I'm a researcher in an area that people don't study. I mean, you know, I have had a successful career sort of not going with the grain. I've done traditional operas and oratorio and other things, but a large part of what I've done has been going against the grain. And so I've always talked to my students about being authentic as performers and figuring out what that means for them.
Dr. Louise Toppin is professor of voice at the University of Michigan. She's been organizing this year's African American Music Conference, which, by the way, will include an original cast reunion from the 1963 performance of Amahl and the Night Visitors. Professor Toppin, it's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much. It has been my pleasure, and I hope people will enjoy coming to celebrate with us this weekend.
Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.